This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
This Feeding Time podcast is brought to you by Plan B, your go-to joint for a quick fix of great grub and wicked coffee, a new perspective to fuss-free dining. This is BFM 89.9. On today's food story in Feeding Time, we'll be talking to Lydia Lubon, a documentary filmmaker whose recent documentary on Sumatran rhinos has just been released. She'll be talking about the foods of her childhood and her Iban cultural heritage, as well as the amazingly weird foods she eats while back in the forest.
By the third year, I had my own rice cooker, and I was making, like, you know, like ginger prawns that my akka taught me how to make and things like that. And my friends would literally come and linger like flies outside my dorm room and be like, Lydia, what are you cooking? Can I have some? So when I got to America, that's when I really realized how much I'd love Asian food.
Later on, she'll be sharing her recipe for pansua ayam with us.
You either spark up the barbecue, or if you have an open fire here in Kuala Lumpur, I think it's very difficult to do an open fire bamboo barbecue.
Also illegal. But first up, here's what I've been eating around town this week. Now, if beef is part of your diet, you know, chances are you are going to be a steak lover, because for some strange reason, steak enjoys a fine long tradition in Malaysia. But long gone are the days when Victoria Station and the ship were the only places at which you can dine on a big slab of meat. These days, steaks are plentifully found around, especially the Klang Valley. And here are some of the best available today. In the cheap and cheerful corner, the institution that is Susie's Corner reigns supreme. The steaks here are served with lashings of sauce, chips and greens on the sides. They also have strangely tandoori, pleasingly crispy yet fluffy roti, martabak, satay and naans. But if you like your steak, then Susie's is a time-tested bet. I would also strongly suggest that you order your meat less done than you usually prefer, because the steaks are served on sizzling hot plates and, as you can imagine, will continue to cook after being sat on the table for some time. Best of all, there's also beer to wash it all down. Susie's Corner is located at 213/26 in Jalan Ampang Batu, 4.5 in Jalan Ulu Klang, and it's open daily from 5:30 p.m. to 5 a.m. In the mid-range corner, there's Lucky Bo in Jalan Bangkong Bangsa. And Lucky Bo serves a bit of a melange, you know, of food, from chicken rice and nasi lemak to burgers and steamboat. But come dinner time, the steaks take center stage, and rightfully so. It's some of the best I've enjoyed in KL, especially at the extremely competitive price points that Lucky Bo offers. The steaks at Lucky Bo are cooked in one of KL's few Yospa ovens, and they come from Margaret River in Australia and in Sanchoku in Japan, and they have an average marbling score of 5 to 6, which is very respectable. You can also expect to pay about 125 ringgit for a 300 gram slab of rib eye, which, if you're a steak lover, you'll know is almost incredibly good value. At the Lucky Bo, you should try the tomahawk. It's a must order. It's exquisitely charred on the outside, delectably medium rare on the inside, and the marbling and the rendered fat, which to me is the best part of eating steak, is irreproachably done. Best of all, the price is half that of hotels, so you can expect to pay 400 ringgit for a 1.2 to 1.3 kilo slab. When you think about all that, there's very little not to like about the steaks there. Get thyself there pronto for a fabulous slab of meat. Lucky Bo is located at 65 Jalan Bangkong in Bangsa. It's open daily from noon to 10 p.m. The phone number there is 03-2092-1222. And remember, the steaks are only available at dinner time. Also using the Yospa for their steaks is the Mandarin Grill at MO. Taking over from where the Pacific used to be, the Mandarin Grill has a standard Blackmore Wagyu, which scores an off-the-scale 10-plus on the marbling rating. They've also got the Black Angus from Australia and various cuts. But I would say that the indisputable crowd favourite has to be the hay-smoked Wagyu ribeye that's served with double-baked cheese souffle and black truffle jus for a more-is-more amazing dish. Even though the beef marbling notches in at the relatively modest 6 only, it provides a great balance of lean to fat, and it's definitely one of the best venues for steak fine dining in Kuala Lumpur. In fact, I would venture to say that Mandarin Oriental's Mandarin grilled steaks are the yardstick by which other steakpreneurs should measure themselves. Mandarin Oriental is located at Jalan Pinang in KLCC. It's open daily from noon to 2:30 p.m. for lunch, and for dinner from 7 to 10:30 p.m. Finally, singing the myriad gospels of dry-aged beef are Korean partners Danny Choi and JK, and they import fresh beef from Australia. and then they dry age it in a hanging cellar for a couple of weeks to get the meat's natural juices completely sealed in before they cook it. Their ribeye in particular is stunningly executed. Order it medium rare because the complexity of the beef has been perfectly retained while dispelling all vestiges of gaminess. Yum. Beto's beef is best enjoyed with a side of their special grilled sweet corn. And Beto is located at Pabrika 1 in Jalan Duta Mas 1. It's open from Monday to Friday from 4 p.m. to midnight and on the weekends from noon to midnight. For today's food story, we have the lovely Lydia Lubon, fresh from the launch of a National Geographic documentary on Sumatran rhinos, which we'll talk about later. But it's great, you just had your launch and you had Jane Goodall, of all the people, at the launch. How amazing was that?
Yeah, it was a great honor to have her.
How long was this documentary, you know, in the process of being made?
It took us 3 years from start to finish to make this documentary. So it was a long, long haul making this documentary. A lot of blood, sweat, and tears and leeches.
Yeah, leeches. I can imagine staying in the jungle filming, well, what would have been the last few remaining Sumatran rhinos, which is also as exhilarating as it is depressing because it's such a sad tale. And you mentioned to me earlier that this was the first Asian or Malaysian documentary being picked up by Nat Geo, you know, which tells you the scale and the magnitude of the story and of the actual content itself.
That's right. It's the first Malaysian documentary to ever be picked up by National Geographic Global. So most documentaries here in Malaysia are aired regionally, but this is the first wildlife documentary to be picked up by Nat Geo Global. So it's airing in over 100 countries all across the globe. So wherever Nat Geo is, this film is airing.
Yeah, it's typical that the problem that's happening in our own backyard has to be highlighted by someone overseas for us to actually take action. But we'll talk more about that later. You're here to share with us your food story, and I believe it's a very fascinating food story because you are, well, I guess you're kind of like the United Colors of Benetton when it comes to your cultural background, right? Because you've got a bit of Iban and you've got American, so it's a good melange of East and West, I think. So as a kid, tell us a little bit about how you grew up and the foods that you loved.
So I'm half Iban and I'm half American. And so I really, really was, I was raised with really traditional longhouse Iban food and at the same time really American food. So I was raised with complete opposite cuisines in the house. So my mom would make things like pastas and pizzas and grilled cheese. Cheese was a foundation of my cuisine growing up, so I just loved cheese. But my aka, my cousin, she was literally brought from the longhouses from the jungles of Borneo over to Kuala Lumpur where I grew up. And my dad told her, whatever you feed yourself, you feed Lydia. Because it was very important to him that I could eat Iban food. And so on one hand, I was eating pizza and macaroni and cheese. And on the other hand, I was eating like hati ayam. Rebus,
wow.
Right? And durian and
tempoyak and all that.
Not tempoyak.
Tempoyak. I don't know how tempoyak crept in there.
Tempoyak is not our food, but Iban food is a lot of boiled, steamed things. And, you know, I was eating like kerang and things like that. And then, of course, I would reach for the cheese as well in the fridge. So I really was raised with a mix of cuisines.
What was the most distinctive characteristic of Iban food? Someone who grew up with it, it seems, was it tasty?
Iban food is very, very simple because the Ibans are from the jungle. And Ibans have to eat whatever they can find in the jungle. So it's like paku pakis, daun ubi, and, you know, ginger, things that grow in the ground, like tapioca and things like that, and fish from the river. And everything is either barbecued in the Iban culture, or it's made in the bamboo,
yeah,
or it's a soup.
Wow.
You know, frying came later. So things were boiled, cooked in the bamboo on an open fire, or soup,
right,
or barbecue, yeah.
Very simple. And they've retained that even till today.
Yeah, even till today, that's right.
So having that strange dichotomy of crazy American food and very, very basic hunter-gatherer kind of food, which one did you used to veer towards? I mean, no prizes for guessing, but you might surprise us.
My mom really liked Chinese Malaysian food. That was one of her favorites. So we ate that in the house as well. So I can't really say one thing was a favorite over the other. I really appreciate the simplicity of indigenous food. And I, of course, love cheese and carbohydrates and gluten, just like everybody else.
Yes.
But at the same time, I really love the cuisine of the Chinese Malaysians. I really love stir fries and sweet and sour and yam baskets. And I really, really, really love Malaysian food.
And did your mom make all that?
My akak made it, yeah.
So your akak is not just indigenous. She's also a great whiz in the kitchen, apparently.
Yeah.
She was pretty talented.
Yeah, she was a great, great cook, yeah. She taught me everything I know in terms of cooking.
So you say that you can cook?
I definitely can cook. You can ask my friends. They'll say I can cook too.
So what would be a typical dinner at home in the Luan household? I mean, when with your akak there and your mom liking your Chinese food and you torn between all these cultures, what would a typical dinner be like?
Well, typical dinners were things like pastas and salads. That was a typical dinner. Because if mom made it, it was going to be pasta, salad, you know, spaghetti, things like that. But if my akak cooked, it would definitely be stir fry, sweet and sour fish, steamed siakap with ginger, of course.
Yeah, like, yeah, right? So good.
Yeah, so we had a lot of ginger, because that is a foundation and a staple of Iban cuisine. The ginger.
Yeah.
Okay. It's in everything.
Do they use a lot of garlic? Because it's not so easy to grow or cultivate over there, right? Or onions even.
Yeah, garlic isn't big in Iban cuisine. Ginger is like one of the main roots to use. Ginger and serai.
Serai, lemongrass, yep. So
yes.
Good.
Yes,
love
those two
lemongrass.
Things. Yeah, me too.
So as you grew up, I imagine you went overseas. So then how did your diet then expand and then, you know?
Yeah, I lived in Malaysia for 18 years from 0 to 17, 18. And then when I went to university in America, then it was only when I went overseas and I was surrounded by a completely different culture. I'm half American and I went to International School of Kuala Lumpur. I went to ISKL. So I grew up in a global environment, so I didn't think about race or nationality. I didn't think about that. Yeah. It was only when I went to America and then I got there and then I really realized, wow, I'm Malaysian. Because I would, you know, squat on the floor and my friends would be like, hey, what are you doing? Why are you squatting on the floor? Like, how do you even sit like that? And I'm like, oh, this is how me and my akak just chop ginger in the kitchen. We just squat. So when I went there, I was surrounded by cheeseburgers and pizza and sandwiches and gluten and bread. And it was all of this Western food. And it didn't take very long for me to start craving Asian food. And I was craving rice. And by the third year, I had my own rice cooker, and I was making, like, you know, like ginger prawns that my akak taught me how to make and things like that. And my friends would literally come and linger like flies outside my dorm room and be like, Lydia, what are you cooking? Can I have some? So when I got to America, that's when I really realized how much I'd love Asian food.
I think that's a familiar refrain with a lot of kids, whether they're bicultural, you know, whether they're Eurasian or whether they're Malaysian or, like me, Chinese, you know. We all went to an international school where color was just not a consideration. You didn't even know that someone was black or brown or, you know, a cafe latte or really, really white milk, you know. And only when you go overseas and you suddenly go, you know.
Yeah.
But also the gastronomic significance also dawns on you, because then you suddenly realize, wow, all this food is just really kind of starchy, kind of like gross. I mean, some of it is nice to be sure, but you then realize, you know, it strikes home and you're so right. And I think it's at that juncture that a lot of people like you then go, hang on, it's time for me to actually start using some of the things that I've picked up at home, because that's the only way you're going to get your fill of food that you love.
That's right.
You know? Right. And surprisingly, it's a food that most people gravitate towards. So maybe then it's not a genetic thing, that it's not like the fact that we're Asian that makes us want to eat the food, but the fact is that the food tastes so much better than a Western food. And I'm going to get killed for saying this.
Yeah, you might get killed for saying that. But I do have to say American Chinese food is
pretty execrable.
It's horrendous. And I will never forget the first time that I had takeout and my friends were at college were like, oh yeah, Lydia, let's just order the Chinese takeout. It's this famous place, blah, blah, blah. And I opened the box and I was like, I can't actually eat this.
It's just sugar.
I just thought, this is horrible. It doesn't even taste like chicken. This sauce is horrible. So of course, it pushed me absolutely to call my akak. on that
recipe.
International calling card and say, give me the recipe for that sweet and sour. I want to make it myself here in America. And I did. And that really, living in a place that didn't have the food of my country pushed me to reach for those recipes, to call my aunties, to get those recipes right, and on summer holidays, cook them to make sure that I came back to America and was able to cook my food. The food of my people.
You could have made a killing out of that, huh? But it's true. I remember watching this documentary, and I used to always think, it'd be good to do a TV show, and I go and explore all these so-called Asian restaurants in the outback, to say Australia or wherever, and to see the interpretation, which is completely nothing like any kind of Asian food you know. Like General Tso's chicken, what's that about? Like, you know, that's not even a Chinese dish, but it's like, you know, anyway. Yeah, so I hear you. I hear you, and I see it's a good thing that pushes us to push the panic button.
Yep.
Because it causes us to learn as well in a way that we wouldn't if we were complacent about it. Next up, Lydia's going to be talking about some of the more interesting things she eats, especially while on shoot in the middle of the forest. This is Feeding Times Food Stories with Faye on BFM 89.9. Awesome new food like the Malaysian corned beef rendang waffle-witch and Christie's crunchy kale salad at Plan B, your new local. You'll definitely not find these anywhere else. You're listening to Feeding Times Food Stories. With me in the studio today, Lydia Lubon, documentary maker, fresh off her Sumatran Rhino documentary, which recently aired, talking about the food of her childhood. Now, what intrigues me more than obviously the American side, because we all know American food, is the Iban side of you. And you mentioned that, you know, I mean, at school, you had a good balance of all the different cuisines that Malaysia has to offer. But you would also obviously also regularly go back to visit your relatives. And that's when the eating adventure really starts, right? So tell us about some of the more interesting things that you've had the joy of consuming.
Oh, there's so many to choose from. Where do I even start?
Well, obviously, sago worms pops to mind because that's the first thing people always offer me whenever I go to East Malaysia.
Yeah, sago worms. I think the Ibans have been eating sago worms for, you know, hundreds of years. And at first, when I first tried them, I didn't like them. I hated them. But that's because they weren't cooked right. And eventually, a relative was able to make them really crispy, fried with garlic. And I tried that particular recipe where they were like super crispy on the outside and creamy on the inside, and they were like garlicky and buttery. I was like, I smelt it and I was like, what are you cooking? And I tasted one and I just thought,
give me some of those worms.
This is good. This is really good. If you cook it just right, I guess it's with everything. If you cook it to the taste of the person eating it.
I think a lot of it is a squeamish factor. If you just expel the fact that, oh my God, I'm eating a worm, it's just a food like any other, and it's a protein food, you know? It's a protein-rich food, so...
Yeah, it's actually really delicious. It's actually really delicious.
Some of the other stuff that you've consumed, which I may not have tried yet?
My uncle and auntie have a cocoa farm in Sarawak, and when he was still able to climb trees, he got a honeycomb, and he barbecued it. And he's like, hey, do you want what I'm eating? And I'm like, okay, what are you eating? And
without then, bees, I hope.
Yeah, no bees. But they barbecued this big honeycomb, and he got like a big like bakul, a big basket. And then he started to tap the honeycomb, and out came larvae.
Oh my God!
And then they tasted sweet.
Oh, so you weren't trying to eat the honeycomb, you were trying to eat the larva that was hiding in there.
Yeah, we were eating the larva.
Oh.
So this is a second worm story.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it was a sort of like warmed up honey bee larva snack of the Ibans. Yeah, and I've eaten black ants.
How would you eat that? I mean, how would
that
they make
also
that?
That was also barbecued as well, like barbecued.
But they're not very substantial to start with. Once you barbecue and they shrivel a little bit more, it's like eating a pimple.
It was a lot of them.
It was a lot of them.
I'm trying to black
that
memory
out. So you have to pick up a handful versus like just the one, right?
Yeah. It would be like
not so good, not one of the most memorable, not one of the more memorably good things that you would have put in your mouth?
No. The sago worm was probably the best. But there was one story that I'll share with you. I think I was about sort of like 13, 14, 15, and my grandmother and grandfather lived in a longhouse. And so we were on a longboat going upriver. My dad, my grandmother, grandfather, we were going to their vegetable farm. So in the jungle, there's not a lot of things to eat, right? There's not a lot of snacks. Here in the city, you can get mami, you can get cheezels, whatever, right? But in the jungle, you can't just buy snacks anywhere. You've got to grab what's around you. So I was hungry. So we went upriver, got to the farm, and then my grandfather went up to the hut, and he was barbecuing something that smelled really good, right? So I went up there and I was like, Aki is grandfather in Iba. And I was like, Aki. I was like, what are you sauteing? It smells so good. He goes, oh, you want some? It's chicken. I said, oh, really? And I didn't see any chickens around, so I thought, okay, well, I wonder where he got this chicken from. So I squatted, you know, the Asian squat with my Aki. Asian squat. He's barbecuing this meat on this stick, and I start to eat it, and I'm like, oh, it tastes pretty good. Like, you know, like barbecue satay. Okay, sit down. Okay. And then he goes, do you want some more? I said, yeah, I'm hungry, because it was only like a little bit, right? The meat was so, like, skinny. So I said, okay, I'll have another one. And he reaches his hand inside a plastic, we call it Adidas Kampong. I don't know if you know what that
Adidas
is.
Adidas Kampong.
You know those plastic farm shoes that you can buy for 8 ringgit? He reaches inside an Adidas Kampong and pulls out a black bat.
Oh, lovely. That's just lovely.
And he goes, you want some more, right? And I was like, Aki, is that what I just ate? And he was like, yeah, that was what you just
ate. Everything tastes like chicken. Everything. You know that.
I was mortified, right? Because I love animals and I'm a conservationist at heart. And I just died in that moment. And I was like, no, Aki, I'm good. I'm good. I'm out of here. And so I ran off to my dad traumatized.
Oh, my gosh. But there was another story that you had told me before about the... what happens to the turtle that crosses the road, right?
Oh, right. Oh, there's so many stories from my family to choose from. And another time we were like, we were in the Jeep, and it was a car full of Ibans. My dad was driving and it was me in the back. And all of a sudden in the distance, in the road, right, in the dirt road, I could see this turtle crossing the road. And I was like, daddy, stop the car. Don't run over the turtle. Let's save the turtle. We can just pick it up. I'll run out, put it in the river, and he'll be safe. I want to save the turtle, right? And my dad stops. And then my auntie in Iban was like, ooh, if we made a soup out of that with a little bit of soy sauce and ginger, that would taste really good. And I was like, oh, man.
Did really? You save it?
Yeah, we saved it.
Oh, good.
Yeah. My dad got out of the car, picked it up, and put it to the side of the
road. Oh, thank God.
Yeah.
And then some other Ibans got it and made soup out of it.
You know what? Yeah. What you don't know can't hurt you. So we just kept driving. Yeah.
But, you know, growing up now and, you know, being a documentary maker and you shoot a lot of that kind of stuff and you're out in the wilderness a lot of the time, how do you then reconcile your beliefs and your, you know, stance as a conservationist versus your need to put food in your stomach and be sustained?
I think when it comes to meat consumption, you know, the cattle industry, the chicken industry, the poultry industry, human beings overconsume. That's a fact. But when it comes to indigenous people, they consume what they need, I find. And we don't consume in mass bulk, and there isn't mass wastage in terms of indigenous people. So it is hard for me to see an indigenous person, you know, slit the throat of a wild boar. That's hard for me, and I've seen that because my family does that. But
they use the whole animal. They don't waste.
Correct.
They only take what they need.
Correct.
And when you're on shoot, I mean, and obviously for this most recent documentary, you would have had to be in the jungle quite a fair bit.
Yeah.
In fact, I remember seeing some of your posts where, you know, 55 leeches today or something like that, where you're just picking off leeches from his skin. But what about the catering? I mean, on these shows, I can imagine it'd be pretty bare bones basic, if at all, existence.
Oh, it's so funny that you said the word catering. Oh, gosh, that... just didn't even like come into the peripheral vision, catering. So on shoot, when we trekked into the Dunham Valley to where the rhino was, the last wild caught Sumatran rhino, when we went in there, we had to trek in for 6 days. And we had to carry all of our clothes, everything we wanted to eat, all of our water, we had to carry it ourselves. Huh? We didn't have like Sherpas. So whatever I wanted to eat, it had to fit in my backpack, and I had to have the strength to be able to carry it. So what I ate was things that were light, like crackers, saltine crackers, like rice crackers. Those are lightweight and they're quite filling. Things like raisins, that's what I ate. So my bag, prior to arriving on location from Kuala Lumpur, my bag, 60% of it, 70% of it, was filled with food. And then the rest was clothes and leech socks. Every time I went on shoot, in a jungle shoot, a majority of the bag is food. And there's a picture on Facebook.
And you can only eat what you can carry.
That's right.
But you didn't do any foraging or any... You would have been well equipped with the skill set to, you know, pick and choose your food? No,
no. The Denon Valley Forest is quite different from the forest of Sarawak.
Very much more sparse in the way of food?
Well, actually, it's sort of like more wild, and there's different kinds of foliage there. And I'm not a jungle forager. I mean, everything that I ate in growing up, you know, my aunties would go and get it. So on my Denon Valley shoot, for this rhino shoot, I ate basically like tuna fish, canned tuna fish, saltine crackers, rice that was carried in by the rhino rangers. They were the ones that carried in the rice. So I would eat whatever leftovers they would throw me. I would just
be so grateful,
right? They brought up like ikan bilis and things like that.
Oh my God, best food ever.
I know. I was like waiting in the sideline. I'm like, whatever you don't want to eat, give it to me.
Just throw it to me. I'll catch it with my mouth.
There's only so much canned tuna I can eat for 6 days straight. Yeah.
Yeah.
I can't eat tuna anymore.
So when you go into the forest and you have to suffer the indignity of canned tuna and saltine for days on end, and then when you come back out, what is the first meal you're going to treat yourself? What sort of food do you invariably head for?
Japanese food.
Japanese food?
Yeah.
Okay, that's
without a doubt. Without a doubt.
Why?
Because Japanese food is my favorite. Now it is. Because it's clean food. My eating habits have changed over the years, and I really appreciate sashimi, raw food, plain steamed rice, miso soup, the simplicity of Japanese food. That is what I go for. I don't want a whole bunch of fried stuff. I don't want nasi goreng or whatever. I don't want anything that's deep fried. It's the simplicity of the Japanese food.
Right.
And nasi lemak.
So tuna sashimi? I'm kidding. I'm kidding. I'm just kidding. Talking about, you know, the shoot for the rhino, I want to also just highlight to our listeners, because I think it's a very important documentary that people need to understand about. And there are, as you said, you know, fewer than 100 Sumatran rhinos left in the wild, and there are only 3 in Malaysia. And these 3 are being cared for by the rhino rangers, who also supply you food when they can't finish their rice. And they're in perilous danger of being shut down because they've run out of funds. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And so your documentary was primarily to highlight the plight of the rhinos, but also to show literally we're on the... I mean, they've been declared extinct in Malaysia, and yet there's so little that's being done to rectify that situation. Tell us a little bit about that. That's appalling. I mean...
These are the last 3 rhinos. We have 1 male and 2 females. Tom is our only male Sumatran rhino left in all of Malaysia, and his 2 girlfriends, Puntong and Iman. And Iman is the last wild-caught rhino out of the wild, and I don't think there will be another one. So the 3 of them are living together in the Taban Wildlife Reserve in Sabah, and they're being cared for by the Borneo Rhino Alliance. And unfortunately, they aren't able to mate together because the females have reproductive challenges. But Iman is still producing eggs. So now, because we only have 3 rhinos left and they cannot mate naturally, there is no choice but to embark on an IVF strategy for the future of the Sumatran rhino. And reproductive science for the Sumatran rhino is very, very costly, and it hasn't been successful yet. And so embarking on this road, the science road, the IVF road, is going to be very, very expensive, because it's going to require expertise from Germany, from all over the world, to actually make this happen. For human beings, it took, you know, a very, very long time for IVF to even work in human beings. So now they're embarking in this road because we've left it too late. We've left it too late. So when you leave it too late, this is what you're going to have to do. You're going to have to, right? You're going to have to look to science.
Yes.
So that's why they're in desperate need of funds right now. Their funds have run out. And if they're not able to raise 100,000 ringgit in the next 4 weeks, unfortunately, the Borneo Rhino Alliance is in danger of having to close down in January. And we don't know what's going to happen to our last 3 rhinos if they do have to close down.
That's horrifying. It's horrifying that we actually have to get to this point. It's really unthinkable. It really is. You know, I personally will be donating, but I will also be giving the listeners a chance to donate. And I urge you strongly, I exhort you to do it, okay? Because every cent counts. Now, you've got a recipe to share with us before we wind up today, and we're not going to let you get away with not sharing that with us. So what is it?
Of course, my most successful dish of all time has been the pansua manua, which is bamboo chicken in Iban. And I've made it for my friends a couple of times, and it's gone down very, very well. naturally, city folk are very impressed with jungle food. And it is chicken in bamboo. You actually have to get bamboo from the jungle. You have to get fresh bamboo, like a pretty big one. One that's about sort of like 3 to 4 inches in diameter so that all the chicken can fit in there. So I can give you the recipe for feeding 12 people.
Sure.
Yeah.
Because everybody's got a 12-member family.
Well, I have a lot of friends that want to eat this dish, so they all sign up. They all sign up to come.
Do it the way you know how.
Yeah, I'll tell you. Yeah. So it's you get two really big things of bamboo, and they're about 1.5 meters high and 3 to 4 inches in diameter wide. And to feed 12 people, you'll need 2 of those bamboos and 2 whole chickens, a lot of serai, bunga kantan. You'll need chicken stock, 3 tablespoons of sea salt, because that's a stronger salt than just the normal white table salt, and a lot of ginger.
Of course, ginger.
Ginger.
Who would have thought?
Yeah, right? Ginger, serai. And you sort of you marinate the chicken with all these ingredients. You slice everything up, marinate it all in there. You leave it for a couple of hours. And then when you either spark up the barbecue or if you have an open fire here in Kuala Lumpur, I think it's very difficult to do an open fire bamboo barbecue.
Also illegal.
Also illegal. So if you don't have the choice of an open fire like an Iban wood in Sarawak, you need to have a friend that has a 3-burner, like big Australian barbecue, one of those with the lids that close with 2 hands. So if you have access to that kind of barbecue, you put the chicken all in there, and what you have to do is you have to layer the chicken with the serai and the bunga kantan, and the ginger slices of ginger. You have to layer it all in there.
So you stuff the chicken, then you put ginger, then you put serai, then you put ginger, then you put chicken, then you put serai, and so on and so
chicken,
forth.
Chicken, serai, chicken, bunga kantan.
So it's like a layer cake vertically with chicken, bunga kantan, and serai.
Correct.
Wow.
Then comes a very important thing. You have to have like 5 kilos of banana leaves, and you roll them up as tight as you can with the same circumference as the opening of the bamboo.
To block it,
and it has to be real tight. I'm talking like tight.
Airtight.
Like airtight.
Okay, got it.
In both. And then you throw it on the barbecue. Don't throw it. Yes.
Gingerly place it
And sideways. And you have to put, like, we have to put a brick to, like, put it like that so that, because there's a little bit of water, you can put, like, a half a cup of water, not too much, at the bottom so that the juices can flow nicely in there and you keep it moist. And
so you rest it at an angle, at a 45-degree angle, in a cup of water that's wedged firmly into the barbecue side.
Yeah.
And the water from the steaming of the barbecue process will draw the water up into the chicken.
Yeah, but the water you put in the bamboo.
Oh, you put in the bamboo so it drips down into the cup.
No. So the bamboo, you pour water inside the bamboo and it sort of keeps everything moist.
Right.
And then you get a brick. You lay the bamboo on a brick so that it keeps it elevated. Because a little bit of water will like
spit out of the
top, out of those banana leaves. And then you just close the barbecue lid over the bamboo. But the bamboo will be sticking out, though.
Right.
It's not easy to make this.
Okay. Yeah. So how long does it take?
You cook it for at least like an hour and a half.
Okay. And then you just dig out the chicken and serve.
Yeah. And you know when it's ready when the water starts spouting out of the top. That's when you know it's ready.
Yeah.
But you've got to learn from the experts. You've got to learn from an Iban
I think in terms of a dish that impresses people, Noen, I think you've pretty much trumped it. You know, most people are like, yeah, I make a carbonara. You're like, no, I stick the bamboo with full of chicken and I put it in a barbecue and I stick water in there. Yeah, no, it's great. Thank you so much. Now, look, guys, vis-a-vis the Rhino Alliance, let me tell you a little bit about it. You can donate. Please donate. Please, please, please donate. Time is of the essence, so please get your skates on. You can go to the BorneoRhinoAlliance.org, /donate/. That's BorneoRhinoAlliance. iance.org/donate/ and find out the information there. And I urge you to do so because they have only till the end of November before they determine that they will shut the shelter. And the last three Sumatran rhinos found in Malaysia, well, you know, their lives hang in the balance. Thank you, Lydia, for highlighting this very important situation to us. Thank you for sharing your really amazing stories as well.
You're welcome.
I hope your next shoot is going to be a little bit less taxing on the gustatory senses.
Yeah, it will be. I think I'll have access to catering for my next shoot.
Fantastic. Thanks. Thank you to Lydia for highlighting the urgent plight of the Sumatran rhino. I urge you all to donate and to do your bit to help them stay, you know, far from extinction. If you'd like to find out more about the show, don't forget to follow us on Facebook. That's facebook.com/BFMFeedingTime. Alternately, follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Miss Koo. That's MISSKHOO. Till next Saturday, this has been Feeding Time with Faye on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.